The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Peter Parker takes us through the history of Guardsmen and homosexuality. Professor Wayne Hunt explains the lessons the Tories could learn from the 1993 Conservative election wipeout in Canada. As the centenary of Franz Kafka's death approaches, Nicholas Lezard explains why an undated entry in Kafka's diaries has been haunting him for weeks. Mark Mason provides his notes on Horse Guards here in Westminster. And finally, Nicholas Farrell ponders over his wife's potential suitors once he's died. Up first, Peter Parker.
In 1943, the music critic Desmond Shaw Taylor placed an advertisement in Exchange and Mart offering a pair of troopers' breeches for sale. A number of men replied, one asking, "Have they been worn by a trooper or just yourself?" While another observed, "It is always good to see the boys pulling themselves into tight troopers and then admire the smashing finish." Members of the household division of the British Army, in their figure-hugging breeches and scarlet coats, had always held a particular appeal for homosexual men. It was therefore fortunate that, though the military authorities publicly denied it, there was a long tradition in Guards regiments of combining ceremonial duties with casual prostitution. It is for this reason that while I was researching Some Men in London, my two-volume anthology of queer life in the capital from 1945 to 1967, Guardsmen kept popping up. In relationships with people such as Stephen Spender, John Layman and J.R. Ackerley, or providing more temporary services for others. In his diaries of the 1940s and 1950s, the civil servant George Lucas provides a startlingly detailed record of many evenings spent at Marble Arch, seeking sex and solace among the guardsmen who congregated there. Such liaisons carried risks, of course. Lucas was several times threatened and robbed, while the theatre critic James Agate, whose flat was hung with photographs by Angus McBain of soldiers who'd somehow mislaid their uniforms, found himself being blackmailed by a guardsman he had bedded. The historian James Pope Hennessy also made such regular use of guardsmen that when he once slept with a woman, she heard him mumble sleepily from beneath the sheets the following morning, "Are you going to shave now, darling, or when you get back to the barracks?" The significant role these mostly obliging soldiers have played in the history of British homosexuality goes back a long way. In July 1822, for example, a major scandal erupted when the Bishop of Clogher was apprehended in the back room of the White Lion public house off the Haymarket, having sex with a grenadier. During the Victorian period, a gentleman who fancied a bit of scarlet had only to take a stroll in those parts of London where the guards had their barracks. John Addington Symonds recalled being approached one evening in 1865 by a guardsman lurking in a passage near the St George's barracks in Orange Street. The soldier said he knew a house nearby they could go to, but Symonds was too nervous to take him up on this offer. 12 years later, Symonds was a good deal less shy, and he took time off from giving lectures at the Royal Institute on Florence and the Medici to spend the afternoon with a brawny young soldier at Mrs. Truman's establishment in Albany Street. This house of assignation, masquerading as a tobacconist's, was conveniently situated next door to the Regent's Park Barracks, then home to the Royal Horse Guards. There are lots of houses in London where only soldiers are received and where gentlemen can sleep with them, says a former foot guard in the anonymously authored 1881 novel Sins of the Cities of the Plain, which, although a work of pornography, is generally agreed to provide an accurate account of London's homosexual underworld at this period. Symonds found that his guardsmen looked upon the affair that brought us together in that place from a businesslike and reasonable point of view. For him, at all events, it involved nothing unusual, nothing shameful. Similarly, the soldier in The Sins of the Cities of the Plain explains, "When a young fellow joins, some one of us breaks him in and teaches him the trick, but there's very little need for that, for it seems to come naturally." Evidence of the continuation of such practices was provided in later criminal trials. In a widely publicised case of 1931, for instance, a 19-year-old Welsh guardsman called Evans, who was accused of demanding £15 with menaces from a man with whom he had regularly been having sex in Hyde Park, stated in court that he'd been inducted in homosexual practices by his fellow guardsman, who had also provided introductions to potential clients. Concern about this case and the press coverage it had received led to a conference being hastily convened, at which military leaders met the Director of Public Prosecutions and senior figures in the Metropolitan Police. The GOC London District, who admitted to having discharged 50 guardsmen in the past year on suspicion of homosexual activity, said that he wanted to develop a feeling in the regiment against this type of offence, while the DPP suggested a course of lectures in which soldiers were warned about the kind of men who might approach them when they were off duty. Such measures were clearly ineffective. Some 30 years later, a guardsman interviewed by Simon Raven for his 1960 article in Encounter on the male prostitute in London said that older soldiers were still advising the newcomer which pubs or bars to frequent or which street corners to wait on and would sometimes offer to accompany him to see fair play. In his memoir of Brian Desmond Hurst, Christopher Robbins recalls the film director announcing one day in the 1970s, "Exciting news! The corporal major of the household cavalry telephoned to say that the colonel had just opened a new box of recruits." The judge in the Evans case said that he was appalled that members of the guards wearing His Majesty's uniform have degraded themselves in a royal park. Hyde Park had, in fact, long been a notorious cruising area for gay men, precisely because Knightsbridge Barracks, where the Household Cavalry was stationed, was on its southern edge. In the mid-1940s, the future MP Ian Harvey was living in Trevor Square, a three-minute walk from these barracks. I noticed on my way home from dinner in the evenings that the troopers, who were in uniform, wandered up and down and then disappeared into the park, he recalled. Under the darkness of the trees, there was a veritable parade. I was intrigued. Harvey became a regular twank, as guardsmen call their clients, and found a very convenient place near the Peter Pan statue in Kensington Gardens in which to have sex. This activity continued on and off for 13 years until he was eventually arrested in 1958 while having sex with a guardsman, not in Hyde Park, but in St James's Park, where homosexual activity was also rife because of its proximity to the Wellington Barracks in Birdcage Walk, home to the Coldstream Grenadier, Irish, Scots and Welsh Guards. Guardsmen touting for business were also found propping up the bars of pubs in the vicinity of barracks. One of the most notorious was the Pakenham Arms in Knightsbridge, which in May 1950 was raided by the police. 30 military personnel, mostly guardsmen, were found on the premises, along with 60 civilians who were known to the police as male perverts. Thereafter, the pub was ruled out of bounds by the military authorities, but there were plenty of other places of assignation, such as the Red Lion in Soho, the Welsh Harp in Covent Garden, the Bag o' Nails on Buckingham Palace Road, and an all-night coffee stall at Victoria Station. It was not until 2016 that the law which made homosexual acts grounds for dismissal from the armed forces was repealed, and rather than giving lectures on how to avoid perverts, the army now provides new recruits with diversity training. Better pay and conditions mean that guardsmen have less need to supplement the king's shilling. But in 2018, it was reported that a member of the household cavalry, who was often seen escorting the royal family, had a parallel career in gay porn films. People affected to be deeply shocked, but it could be said that the soldier was simply adapting a time-honoured tradition for the modern age.
That was Peter Parker. Next, Wayne Hunt.
As the Conservatives inch closer to electoral disaster in the general election, the hunt is on for a fitting historical analogy. Tony Blair's dispatching of John Major in 1997 was mild compared to what polls say could now be in store. Those asking each other, how bad could it get, do have one example in mind. Canada's 1993 election, where a Conservative majority government showed the world just how far it is possible to fall. Brian Mulroney, the Prime Minister, had seemed to usher in a new Conservative era when he was elected in 1989 with a rejuvenated coalition of voters. He had managed to cross Canada's equivalent of a red wall by winning support in his native Quebec, French Canada had traditionally been the turf of the Liberals, but not enough was done to keep this unlikely coalition of voters together. A recession led to cost of living pressure, which was compounded by constitutional mayhem. Mulroney, sensing the inevitable, resigned in 1993. Kim Campbell then took charge and hoped to turn things around. She called an election close to the end of the party's five-year parliamentary term. But a new centre-right party had emerged, calling itself Reform. It was populist, bold, brash, socially conservative, and influenced by the Christian right. It took aim at a myopic political class, and its message to voters was that it was time to vote down a tired consensus that did not move, either physically or imaginatively, out of the nation's capital. When the election was called, Reform was at about 12% in the polls. Almost identical, in other words, to Richard Tice's Reform Party today. Canada's establishment is sometimes called the Laurentian elite, after the Laurentian Mountains in Quebec. Bourgeois in their habits and mores, the denizens of this particular political bubble disdained those who did not reside within their comfortable Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal orbit. The Liberal Party of Canada became the front for this bien pensant establishment for most of the country's political history. They had produced a cycle only broken when the Conservatives somehow managed to harness discontent in the hinterland. John Diefenbaker in 1958, Mulroney in 1984. But in 1993, the Liberal Party was led by Jean Chrétien, a millionaire lawyer who nonetheless played the class card and portrayed himself as a little guy from a small town in Quebec. He promised financial stability, fiscal restraint, and all the rest. It worked. He was swept to power, the separatist Bloc Québécois became the official opposition, and votes for the brand new Reform Party were concentrated in a way that they ended up with 52 seats in the House of Commons. And Kim Campbell's Progressive Conservatives? The polls, which had looked almost unbelievably bad for them throughout the campaign, had flattered them. They ended up with 16% of the vote, so thinly spread that they went from 195 seats to just two. To this day, it is the worst defeat suffered by any governing party in an advanced democracy. It could, and perhaps should, have been an extinction-level event. But instead, the Conservatives regrouped and were back in power within 13 years. How? Stephen Harper, who led the Conservative comeback and became Prime Minister in 2006, was one of the founders of the Reform Party. Elected in that 1993 election, he tried to build his base, but failed to break Reform out of his Western Canada base. He left elected politics, but returned in 2002 to become leader of a revamped Reform Party, renamed Canadian Alliance. He then merged it with the old Conservative Party to form the Conservative Party of Canada. Had Reform swallowed the Conservatives, or vice versa? Either way, the right had been revived and reunited. The lesson is that a party rejected utterly, as Labour was in 2019, and the Tories may well be this year, needs to show that it has changed. Harper did this by being competent in dodging the culture wars being conducted by mainstream Canadian media. He was no populist and avoided talk of immigration. He knew that if he did, the Conservatives could not win seats. This was a different age. The demographics of an aging society with low productivity levels relative to the United States meant that Canada had to bring in more working-age newcomers. Many immigrant families instinctively voted for the party that brought them to the country, which meant the Liberals. To change this dynamic, Harper kept immigration levels high. He also avoided big-ticket constitutional issues and did what he could to keep spending down, including on the military. A NATO member, Canada was content to free-ride on other countries for a considerable time. Canada eventually tired of Harper, who was defeated by Justin Trudeau in 2015. Now it's Trudeau's turn to grate. His approval ratings are almost as bad as those of Rishi Sunak. Trudeau has two more years to go, but his demise looks almost as certain as that of the Tories because Canada's Conservatives seem to have reinvented themselves again under Pierre Poilievre, another bilingual leader. For years, Trudeau's tactic was to portray his opponents as extremists. But he overreached during COVID when truck drivers protesting vaccine mandates were accused of ideologically motivated extremism and had bank accounts frozen on that basis. Poilievre defended them and has since become a fast learner. He has recognized how to come across as a defender of common sense and is known for his homemade videos on subjects such as housing and the cost of living. A conservative-dominated media ecosystem has started to take shape and gain traction. Trudeau is sticking to his one strategy, trying to portray Poilievre as Mr. Trump North. But this has failed to take hold because conservatives in Canada have learned to keep both tight party discipline and a laser-like focus on real-world economic issues. It is too late for the conservatives in Britain, who are the ones proposing vaccine passports, to learn from Canada this time around. But when it comes to rebuilding the party, Canada offers an instructive example in both the flame and the phoenix.
That was Wayne Hunt, now Nicholas Lezard.
How do you see Franz Kafka? That is, how do you picture him in your mind's eye? If you're Nicholas Mahler, the writer and illustrator of a short but engaging graphic biography of the man, you'd see him as a sort of blob of hair and eyebrows on a stick. The illustrations of Completely Kafka may look rudimentary, but they work. In fact, they're similar in style to the doodles Kafka himself would make in his notebooks. If you were Kafka, you'd see yourself as a spindly man, head on desk, leaning on your hands, arms bent, in a posture of defeat and exhaustion. That image is chosen for the cover of a translation by Mark Harmon of Selected Stories. But if you are Penguin, publishing a new edition of the diaries, you'd use the photograph of Kafka in his late 30s, standing in a Prague square, eyes hidden by his hat's brim, but with an amused smile on his lips. Photographs of Kafka are always of a young man, since he died of tuberculosis at the age of 41. His death was in 1924, hence the present glut of books by and about him. The Prague photograph is well chosen because it reminds us that there is humour in Kafka and that he wasn't solely the prophet of a century of dehumanisation. And at least none of the books I've seen have a drawing of a giant beetle on the cover. Kafka's early work wasn't quite as sui generis as you might imagine. When first published, he reminded people of the Swiss author, Robert Walser, whose naive style was unlike what we think of Kafka today as the chronicler of uneasy dreams. Harmon translates Unruhigen in the opening sentence of Die Verwandlung as restless. In meticulous footnotes, he tells us why he's chosen to translate certain German words the way he has. Nailed fast, fast genagelt, like its English counterpart, the German expression, is so common that it has lost much of the literal meaning that it once had. Nevertheless, the mention of Gregor Samsa's being nailed has supplied a grist for the interpretations of the transformation as a kind of radically revamped passion story, with Gregor as the suffering Christ. There are many footnotes like that, informative and judicious, not imposing any rigid interpretation, but suggesting them. The endnotes are also useful, as when Harmon observes that three mentions of fur should remind us of Leopold von Sacher Masoch's Venus in Furs. Gregor is the pseudonym the protagonist Severin adopts when in the service of the dominatrix of the title. The apparatus to the Selected Stories takes up almost half the book, but it is not a burden at all. It is very welcome. There are plenty of endnotes to the diaries too, 1,403 of them to be precise. This may look overwhelming, but it works out at not much more than two a page, which is hardly excessive. On the other hand, 670 pages might seem that. Yet Kafka, for all that people say, but he's also funny, is a serious writer and needs to be taken seriously. The notebooks that contain the material that forms the diaries aren't exactly bristling with gags, but they are certainly worth reading. Diaries isn't quite the right word, since by no means are all the pieces dated. One entry might be followed by another from a year later in the haphazard way in which we keep notebooks, not intended for posterity, but simply as aide-mémoire, to be discarded or expanded elsewhere. Max Brod, who ignored Kafka's instructions to burn his unpublished writings, smoothed the notebooks into something more homogeneous and less chaotic. As well as long sections of works abandoned or later hugely modified, we get random enigmatic utterances. Many of these the editor and translator Ross Benjamin explains or attempts to contextualise in the notes, but there are also many that he doesn't. For instance, "I tightened the reins," a sentence which stands alone between the entries for the 1st and 2nd of August 1917. I am not enough of a Kafkologist to try to link this to anything else in his oeuvre, but Benjamin doesn't try either. These unsupported utterances reinforce the impression of our being close to the reality of what these diaries actually are. Brod also removed the occasional unflattering reference to himself and played down Kafka's sexuality, which seems, in modern parlance, to have swung both ways. Some think Brod had too heavy a hand when it came to editing the notebooks, but he saved them from the flames, so as far as I'm concerned, he could do with them what he liked as long as the originals survived. In his preface, Benjamin tells us what he and Brod were dealing with. 12 quarto notebooks and 2 bundles of loose paper filled with dense handwriting, crossings out, corrections and insertions squeezed in wherever possible, between the lines, in the margins, drawings here and there. So not impossible, but not a walk in a Prague park either. He continues, "Their afterlife has consisted of a long, complex and fraught reckoning with the question of what fidelity the original means in this special case." This edition of the diaries seems a model of both scrupulousness and generosity. Here we find the unpolished inner life of one of the most significant writers that ever lived, and the entries which come from the mind of an ordinary human being and not from some otherworldly realm of inner consciousness do not in any way detract from Kafka's work. They often show, as the photograph of Kafka in Prague suggests, a man wryly amused by his surroundings and the ways of the world. The Great War troubles him hardly at all, exempted as he is by poor health. Marching tunes get stuck in his head, that's about the size of it. If there is one entry, though, that encapsulates his work, his method, his way of thinking, it is a single, unsupported sentence, undated, but presumably written in September 1912. "I, only I, am the observer of the ground floor." What does he mean by this? The base ground floor of the human soul? The apartment block behind him in the photograph where his parents lived? Benjamin doesn't say, and I'm glad he doesn't. It's a sentence that has been haunting me for weeks.
That was Nicholas Lezard, now Mark Mason.
Will they never learn? The signs are very clear. Beware, horses may kick or bite. Yet last week, a woman became the latest tourist to get a shock at horse guards when the animal she was fussing suddenly turned its head and bit her arm. She was unhurt, but you can see why the animals occasionally lose their rag. They're there to protect the monarch, after all. Sending a gentle message once in a while can't do any harm. This small patch on Whitehall is where the King's Lifeguard do their thing because it's still classed as the official entrance to Buckingham Palace. The building also used to house the office of the Commander-in-Chief of the British Army. Prince Frederick, the Grand Old Duke of York, and Wellington both worked there. The latter's coffin rested in the room the night before his funeral. These days, the ground floor is home to the excellent Household Cavalry Museum, where you'll find the wooden leg used by the Earl of Uxbridge after his real one was hit by a cannonball at Waterloo. "By God, sir, I've lost my leg," he cried. "By God, sir, so you have," replied Wellington. Look closely at the clock on top of the building, and you'll see the stone underneath the 2, marked as 10, the face spells out minutes rather than hours, has a black dot on it. This is said to commemorate the time of Charles I's execution on the 30th of January 1649, outside the banqueting hall over the road. The dot isn't a regular shape, which might imply an accidental blemish, but the authorities certainly haven't done anything to clean it up, so they obviously like the story as much as anyone. The parade ground gets its annual day in the spotlight as the venue for Trooping the Colour, which originated with different regiments being shown their flags, or colours, on the battlefield, so they could stay together during the fighting. The ceremony used to take place on the monarch's actual birthday, but Edward VII was the 9th of November, and he didn't fancy the weather, so he created an official birthday in the summer. In 1981, Marcus Sargent fired blank shots at Queen Elizabeth II, The previous week, he'd stolen a copy of The Day of the Jackal, Frederick Forsyth's novel about a plot to shoot Charles de Gaulle, from one of his fellow college students. This just happened to be Sean Williamson, who later went on to play Barry in EastEnders. A decade later, Horse Guards was the scene of another assassination attempt, when three mortars sailed across the parade ground towards 10 Downing Street. The IRA were more professional than Sergeant, but they were unlucky. A mark had been left on Horse Guards Avenue, near the junction with Whitehall, telling the driver of the van from which the mortars were fired exactly where to park. But snowfall had covered it up, so the driver had to guess. The mortars fell short. John Major survived. During the 2012 Olympic Games, Horse Guards Parade was the venue for one of the most eagerly anticipated events. There was some speculation that the Foreign Secretary might take a look, but sadly it wasn't to be. "For those asking," tweeted William Hague, "I can't see the beach volleyball from my office." He did, however, confirm that he tried.
That was Mark Mason. Finally, Nicholas Farrell.
Ever since I had a brush with death a couple of years ago, I have often wondered who my far younger wife, Carla, might marry after she has buried me. When I was out for the count in intensive care in Ravenna, the hospital's duty priest, an Argentinian, even administered the last rites. "They do it just in case these days," Carla told me, as if it had all been a bit of a laugh, which I suppose it may well be, if you believe, like her, that death is the prelude to eternal life. The other day, a herd of donkeys came charging into our garden out of the blue, and I soon put two and two together. They belonged to our nearest neighbour, Janny, a farmer. Though rather on the short side for a cowboy, Janny does look and behave like one, with his Stetson hat and red handkerchief tied around his throat. The five donkeys made a beeline for our donkey, Pepper, who, poor thing, lives all alone, just like Janny. Even though separated from her unexpected guests by an electric fence, Pepper was as happy as Larry, swishing her tail and fluttering her eyelashes. Soon Janny arrived in his white Suzuki Samurai Jeep and jumped out to swagger about with a halter and rope and demonstrate his corralling skills. "Someone must have let them out," he said. "Who might that have been?" I asked. "I have no idea." Within minutes, he had the halter on the boss donkey, and off he went, with the other four obediently following. He would be back later for the jeep. Call me paranoid, but I believe he let his donkeys out, knowing very well that they would end up paying Pepper a visit, and he could ride to the rescue. It is all part of a pattern. Why, for example, does he spend so much time at the wheel of his jeep, processing back and forth along the dirt road outside our house? Or else, worse, prancing up and down on his prize mule, which he won in a game of poker? What's that all about? It is not as if the track goes anywhere except to two more houses a mile and a half further on. No, he's just setting out his stall, biding his time, waiting for the Inglesey to kick the bucket. Another of his donkeys has just given birth to a beautiful baby donkey, which the youngest of our six children adore. "If I hadn't stayed up all night and pulled her out myself," he announced, "she and her mother would both be dead." Janny not only saves life, he enables it. How could any woman resist such a man? There are many other candidates on my list of suitors, such as Gabriele, a travelling salesman who lives in Lido di Dante on the coast a mile away. He is popular with women because he is fun, and as Carla says, he listens to them, or pretends he does. Lido di Dante has a famous nudist beach, and nudists have many subspecies, including voyeurs and swingers, and Gabriele is the expert on what they all get up to. He is the Pied Piper of Dante's Beach, and able to guide anyone through all the circles of hell, should they so desire. The closest thing we have to the great poet who, exiled from Florence, wrote the Divine Comedy in these parts. Carla is a devout Catholic, which offers some protection. She became one only after exposure to me and then insisted I become one too, which I did. Lately, she has been attending quite a lot of funerals as if they were rehearsals. I love funerals, she says. Surely not. Why? I asked her. They give me hope, or rather what Don Mauro says at them does. Ah, yes, portly Don Mauro, our parish priest. He is the person who perhaps more than anyone knows best, better than me, her husband, what Carla is thinking as he hears her confession. She also communes with him via WhatsApp. At Mass on Sunday, he presided over a beautiful baptism. The parents were an Italian man with a pigtail and a statuesque West African woman. Their two other small children were also present. The church was full, but theirs and ours were the only children. Their new child was christened Dylan. The church is a 1970s concrete version of the nearby Basilica of Sant'Apollinare in Classe, which is famous for its 6th-century Byzantine mosaics. Don Mauro has been transferred here from there, and we have followed him. The building's rear entrance is a glass wall, and at a certain point, I and those members of the congregation, with plenty to feel guilty about, noticed over our shoulders a navy blue Carabinieri patrol car pull up and park just outside. Thoughts of imminent arrest and earthly castigation now competed with those of birth and death, eternal salvation and damnation. Don Mauro finished the baptism. The congregation applauded. Mass ended after Holy Communion, and his concluding words, "Go in peace." While he held the baby Dylan in his arms for the family photo, two Carabinieri officers came into the church, but only to say hello to the organist, who was a retired colleague, I found out later. If it really must happen, it's a pity it can't be Don Mauro Carla hooks up with, I thought.
And that's everything for this week. If you enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of this week's Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.